Hello, and welcome to The Hump with Katie Thoreau. I'm your host, Katie Thoreau, and I'm so thrilled to bring you our very first episode today. I'm interviewing some incredible musicians and finding out, why are they so amazing? How did it happen? And what can we learn from their journey? Before we get started today, I'd like to thank our sponsors. And first up, we have DiscoverDoubleBass.com. It's a wonderful online learning resource for bass players, and they have full-length courses from some of the best teachers out there. I happen to have a course up there myself called From Beginner to Bandstand, and it's perfect if you used to play bass and you want to get back into jazz bass, or you are really a beginner. I'm giving you some great focus and jazz techniques to get you out of that practice room and get you on the bandstand playing the music that you love. So check that out if you'd like to look at my course From Beginner to Bandstand. Use the promo code Katie, K-A-T-I-E, when you check out, and you'll get 25% off. And do take a look at the rest of the website. They have incredible information for everyone from a beginner, intermediate, to a super pro level. So that's DiscoverDoubleBass.com. Our next sponsor is the clothing company Jams World. If you've ever seen me before, you know that I like to wear colorful clothing. This is Jams World, and I absolutely love it. They're a clothing company based in Honolulu, Hawaii, all made in the U.S. by hand. And I love it because I feel like I'm wearing a piece of art. It's super comfortable, and I sweat a lot when I play, and it's very breathable fabric. So it's dual function for me. I feel good when I'm playing, and I feel good when I'm playing. So that's jamsworld.com. Use the promo code JAZZ15, J-A-Z-Z-1-5, and get 15% off your entire purchase. And just as just a reminder, I'll be releasing new episodes of The Hump every Wednesday, every hump day. So come back. We'll be on Instagram, YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at The Hump with Katie for updates, teasers on who's going to be on the show. And I'm just so excited to bring you this every Wednesday. Okay, now it's time to bring you our very first guest, the great bassist Edwin Livingston. I refer to him as the silent badass because he is all over the scene. Everything from performing, recording, touring, film, TV, appearing in national commercials. He's played with everyone from Elvin Jones, Ellis Marsalis, Mary J. Blige, John Legend, Seal, Natalie Cole. The list goes on and on. I don't know how this guy has time in the day to even talk to me. So we're so lucky to have him on the show as our very first guest. So without further ado, here's Edwin Livingston. I want to thank you so much for being the first guest for The Hump with Katie. And cool. I know it's a provocative name for those who don't know what a hump is, but to us bass players, it refers to something that feels good. I'm still not getting to the right point. Feels good in a beat that feels good. So yes. Thank you so much for being our very first guest.
Of course, my pleasure.
And for those of you who don't know Edwin, you do know Edwin. I call you the silent badass because you have seen him, you have heard him, and you don't even know it. I don't need to say much because we're going to figure everything out about Edwin right now and solve the world's problems via bass right now. So we're just going to get right into it, Edwin. And first I'll just ask, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. You know, this is, you know, a very challenging and, you know, I guess a very unusual and challenging time right now for many reasons, not just because of the pandemic, but, you know, this a long time coming with race relations. So there's a lot going on that I have to unpack.
Yeah.
But, aside from all that, no complaints, you know,
okay.
I'm alive, healthy. I'm doing a lot of recording here at the house, actually, but good.
Good, good. You? I'm good. Yeah, I can see. It seems like you can record any type of music with what you've got going on back there.
Yeah, I got all kinds of stuff. Bells and whistles.
Okay. I know, yeah, we could play bass and use a samba whistle at the same time.
Exactly.
Which I did once, actually, in eighth grade. That's another story.
And that's why it became who you are today.
Exactly. That's what made me who I am, the samba whistle. Well, you know what? I'm so curious about you, Edwin, because you're such a nice person, and it completely matches your musicianship. And that, as we know, doesn't always happen, doesn't match up.
Totally.
You know, the downfall is like, oh, Edwin's a really nice guy, but his playing, you know.
Yeah.
So some people, nobody says it about you. I'm making that up right now.
Because people always say, I never meet your heroes or something like that, because you know, some people are amazing musicians or composers, and when you meet them, they are just jive as can be. Mm-hmm. So it's nice when that's not the case.
Yeah, exactly. So how did that happen? How did you, I know you've lived in a couple places during your life and maybe that helped shaped it, but you're originally from Dallas?
That's correct. Yeah.
So was music always there from the start? How did it happen?
I'm not from a musical family necessarily. I guess there's music on my mother's side, but my parents did not play. Mm-hmm. My brother played trombone, my older brother. For some reason, but my mom and dad always had music in the house. They always were playing records and tapes back in the day, you know, mm-hmm. vinyl and everything back in the good old days. I've always been drawn to it. I was a singer back when I was much younger. I was a second soprano back in the...
Wow, get out. Wow.
My youth, back in the boys' choir.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Choir back in the day. And that, you know, so yeah, I've always enjoyed it. And I decided to pursue music fully when I was in high school, when I was taking lessons from a guy named Roger Fertina. He is the assistant principal in the Dallas Symphony. Mm-hmm. And he is a badass. Nice guy, but very strict, you know, very stern. There's no, it's like, no, hey, you're almost there. that was not right.
Yeah.
That was out of tune. Do it again. Mm-hmm. He was very, very strict, which is good. That's what the youngsters need sometimes, a little more like, hey, look, that's not right. Let's do it again.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, then how did you get to the bass then?
I was in the choir first in elementary school. Then I started playing the saxophone because I wanted to be a drummer because we don't fully start band in Texas until middle school. Mm-hmm. So in the sixth grade, I wanted to play the drums. And they say we have too many drummers in the band program already. This would be in beginner band in sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. And they said, so choose something else. So there were no string departments in the city where I grew up. So it was all band. Mm. So I played the saxophone. And then one day, like in the seventh and eighth grade, somewhere between those two grades, I was, you know, at private lessons, you know, half an hour a week, whatever. And the saxophone guy was like, yeah, but you don't seem to be really improving. I was like, yeah, I don't want to play the saxophone. He's like, what do you want to play? I said, the bass. He's like, well, you should play the bass. And at that point, it's hard to convince your parents to buy another instrument mm-hmm. that you may not fully be invested in. So there was a back and forth in between myself and my parents, me mainly pitching a fit, I want a bass. And they're like, but you're not playing the saxophone you have now, so we're not going to get it. I'm sure it happens quite a bit, but they relented, and I got an electric bass at that point. And I played the electric bass in the eighth grade, and then from then on. But I didn't start playing the string bass until the 10th grade, which is kind of late for a lot of people. That's what my teacher told me also. The guy said, yeah, you're in the 10th grade, and you're starting on double bass. He goes, you're late, first of all. So you got to really, you know, shed and practice. Yeah. Because if you go to college playing double bass, you got to get really good fast. So that was, you know, I said, okay. So.
So you went for it.
Yeah, yeah. I said, hey, look. And especially then, because at that point when I started playing the double bass, I was still in the band. So I was the only string instrument playing in a concert band. Mm-hmm. Playing a tuba parts, and those parts are written, you know, lower than an actual bass part is. So it's a lot of ledger lines and also just kind of cumbersome to read. So it wasn't until I started playing in an actual a youth orchestra in Dallas called the Greater Dallas Youth Orchestra, then I realized, like, wow, so this is what a bass should be sounding like in its proper context. Mm-hmm. You know? And then I realized, okay, this is what I really want to do.
That's interesting because I feel like a lot of people in your situation, like they played one instrument and then they're forced to play the bass because no one's playing it, right? There's just that thing in the corner and the teacher's like, you have to play that now. And And also, when you were when you started playing upright, was it one of those like insatiable things where it was like, okay, let me figure this out, or it was just kind of day by day?
I don't know. It was a school bass. It was an Engelhardt, probably. It was a horrible plywood instrument where the action was jacked, you know. And at the time, I drove a truck in high school, so there's I had a bed, you know, a pickup. I just had to put the bass in the back of the bed and had to drive carefully because there's a fragile string bass sliding around the back. So it was you know, high school, man. It's, you know, you gotta make it happen.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where my teacher, like, I was playing and taking lessons, and he's like, well, you need to really play with other string players to see exactly how you fit in. Mm-hmm. That was when I had an audition for the Dallas or the Greater Dallas Youth Orchestra. And then I realized exactly what my role would be. And then at that point, I was in the jazz band in high school, and I was reading more, quote unquote, you know, all those Hal Leonard charts, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff. And I really wanted to get good at it because it was fun at that point, because I'm playing an actual, and I knew the pitches because of electric bass, but the fingering and the technique is all different. Yeah. So that was the main thing I had to get together, was the technique and the intonation and just knowing the muscle memory and looking at the fingerboard and just seeing where things go.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that that having some training as a singer helped at all doing that on the bass?
Well, it's funny because I had a really good pitch reference. So I know how songs went on the radio. Like I could find a pitch fairly easily. And I think it did have a good reference for me for the double bass. Because when it came down to like theory practice, like finding notes and chords, some things came fairly easy to me, yeah, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then also, then I'll move on. At that time when you're just discovering the upright and getting into jazz, were there some of those records and bass players that were just kind of those mind-blowing types of moments for you?
Well, it's funny because my dad took me to this street festival in Fort Worth, you know, and it's just he and I, he said, hey, let's go to the street fair. And Fort Worth is like about 45 miles from where I grew up, in a suburb of Dallas, really. You know, so on the other side of the whole Metroplex, we just drove up because he worked in Fort Worth. So mm-hmm. that's where he knew about this festival. So I grew up there watching all these bands, and I'm watching this one band, and, you know, this guy's playing, and I'm like, you know, I'm just checking him out. And if for some reason, either I approached him or maybe he just came down because he knew that I was looking at him the whole night. I don't know. We went to North Texas. I recall that because he said, yeah, man, I go to North Texas. I'm just, you know, blah, blah, blah. We're doing this gig down here. And I recall him asking me, had I heard of Charles Mingus? And I was like, never heard of him. Didn't know what he was or who he was or what he was about. He goes, well, man, go check out some Mingus. He's a, you know, blah, blah, blah. So the first quote unquote jazz record that I actually went out and bought myself was a tape.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called The Clown.
Yeah.
And it was amazing.
And that was the first stuff you've heard.
I mean, I think I had heard maybe some other stuff, but I really, because I think my dad had My Funny Valentine and Four and More on mm-hmm. vinyl. But when I was playing it, I couldn't really hear the bass at times because I didn't really know what I was listening for. You know, yeah. I couldn't exactly what I was trying to focus on. And of course, at the time, I didn't know who Ron Carter was or Herbie or Wayne or all that. I knew Miles. I said, okay, Miles plays trumpet. I guess he's on the front cover, you know. I'm making an assumption at that point.
Yeah.
But after that, then I soon realized that, okay, Ron's playing that, you know, in crazy fast intro or the head on So What? Because it's way faster than the studio version. So mm-hmm. I'm like, that's the bass doing that? Like, you know, freakishly fast. As then I was, oh, so that's what the bass player's doing. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, after I heard the Mingus thing, you know, The Clown, and then hearing a Haitian Fight song and Blue Sea and seeing what the bass did on that, and then listening to the Miles again, then I really realized exactly what the bass is actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
And also the pitch reference and knowing, okay, so that's where the pitch range and frequency is for this double bass. And that really helped me, you know.
That's cool too to come have an introduction via Mingus too, you know, a composer someone who's really out in the, out front there, really present, and realizing that a bass can do everything pretty much.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, so and then you went to Wichita, right?
I did for my undergrad. Yeah, I went to Wichita State. Yeah, with a great a bass teacher named Mark Foley up there. He's still there.
Yeah. And how was it? How was it spending? Were you there for 4 years?
I was there for 4 years. And the cool thing about that was a classical degree because they didn't have a jazz. They didn't have an actual jazz degree, so I just have a degree in performance. And that was mainly in classical. The jazz stuff I did on your own. And like, you know, there's combos and big band. That was all the stuff because I wanted to. But the bulk of the study was in classical. So, you know, the Hindemith Sonata, Koussevitzky, all the usual stuff, you know, trying to work it out. But one of the cool things about it is there is Wichita Symphony there, and that is a regional orchestra. Part-time for most musicians, and I think it's quasi full-time for the principals. And all the principals, many teach at the school also, so it kind of makes sense. And they had a bass opening, you know, and I auditioned for the Wichita Symphony like 3 times, and I finally got in third time. So I was able to have an actual, quote-unquote, full-time gig in a part-time orchestra, or a part-time gig in, you know, part-time orchestra. So it was great.
See, and this is why you're a silent badass, Edwin.
Yeah, well, that because I didn't really understand, especially like all the pieces that they were playing, and these were all like, you know, pros, the most part. And we had, you know, it was all the same usual special guests. You know, we had Emmanuel Axe would come in, get this famous Spanish violinist, but it's, you know, normal. Frequent classical soloists would come for the orchestra, just like any other, you know, orchestra. So I was exposed to a lot of different kinds of music. And there again, performing in front of, you know, a live audience really helps. You know, I had, you know, it was good for me to really cut my teeth on the actual repertoire of the double bass, you know.
Yeah, and playing in a section too, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I mean try and tune that low F with, you know, 6 other bass players.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because that's when you really realize, I mean, when, if you're going to do like Beethoven's Scherzo, you know, Beethoven's Fifth, I mean, you really realize, oh, so that's how this sounds in context. Because when you play it by yourself, it doesn't always have the same meaning, or the same weight. And then when you hear it in context, like, wow, so this is what's going on with all this. It's, you know, it's really amazing to see that.
Yeah.
And to feel that, and then feel the air moving, and then watching the principal trying to look down the line, see if everybody's bows are going in the same direction.
Yeah. You know?
And then playing in tune with your stand partner, or who's got to turn pages. I have to turn pages all the time, so you got to figure out how to turn pages.
Yeah.
You know, don't lose your spot on the music, you know, and, you know, it's a good lesson for me.
Yeah, that was always an issue for me. It was like, do I put my bow in my teeth, turn the page, you know, things go flying.
Well, yeah, because you never think about it until you're there and you realize, wow, at a concert, it's dead quiet. Everyone is in freaking tux with tails, so you know it's like a big deal. And, you know, the quietest page turn is like, everyone's looking like, hey, this is piano. Why are you making all the noise down there? So it's a big deal, yeah.
And so when you were in the symphony, were you also playing jazz gigs at that time while you were at school?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I was playing jazz. I was playing whatever I could, you know, because I had to make some money. Mm-hmm. It's just like, it's funny because it seems so different nowadays. But back in the 90s, back in the good old days, I mean, I was, you know, it was amazing that cats were graduating because, man, we had jazz gigs, any kind of orchestra gig that we could get, you know, anything to make some money. And I also had it was a funk, hardcore, hip hop, reggae, ska band called Sugarbush.
Oh, I was going to ask what the name was. Thank you.
Yeah. And we were doing ripoffs of like Fishbone, Funkadelic, 24/7 Spies, a little bit of Bad Brains, and still trying to do all that, and still go to school, extra classes, play a recital. Learn pieces in tenor clef, Ugh, yeah. I'm not sure why people still write in tenor clef, but it's still a thing.
It is a thing. You know, I prefer a tangent here. Like, I just read treble clef, right? And I don't like reading bass clef up the octave.
I agree.
That gets me.
I agree.
I'll get down with treble clef. That's fine.
Yeah. Bass and treble, I'm down. Not this tenor is just like
up the fifth and all that, you know.
Sound seems obsolete to me, but that's not my call. But
yeah, I'm just gonna put a disclaimer out there for all the classical aficionados out there. I'm not sorry, but that's just what I prefer.
Same.
Okay.
I'm deeply sorry, but yeah. That's me. Bass and treble. Anyway.
So how many seasons did you get to play with the symphony?
Because I was part-time with them, I think, for 1.5. And I was full-time with them. There again, when I say full-time, it's full-time in a part-time orchestra. Mm-hmm. So I think it's probably, season starts in October. I think I was full-time with them maybe a year or two.
Wow, that's so awesome. Yeah, you must have played so much great music.
It was amazing. I played a Carmina Burana, which I never knew what it was until mm-hmm. I played it. It's like, oh, that's what it is in all these movies. You know, it's one of those things you don't really realize until you do it. Mm-hmm. It's like, so that's where this goes. Or Verdi's Requiem.
Yes, yeah. You know,
the whole animal thing. I'm like, what? I didn't know. I wasn't here. No, nobody told me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a great experience for me. Yeah.
Okay, this is really shaping what you do today now. I can totally realize that. Okay, so you finish school, you get your degree in performance.
Yes.
And then what happens? You kind of moved around a little bit, right?
I moved to Austin, Texas, or back to Texas, moved down to Austin, which is like a big music town. And that was great. You know, there again, not one classical gig at all, but a whole lot of other stuff, which was cool. You know, because at that point, it doesn't really matter as long as you are growing as a person and as a musician. And that was all kinds of stuff. Like I said, that was jazz, any kind of pop thing, mm-hmm. any kind of experimental, whatever. Like, I was in a double trio called Hot Buttered Rhythm. And that was two keyboard players, two drummers, and two bass players. Mm-hmm. And I played upright, and the other guy played electric bass. And we, you know, it was, there again, that taught me how to play with another bass player.
Yes.
That's not a very common thing to do.
No.
So you got to figure it out.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so if he's doing that, I got to do something else.
Mm-hmm. You
know, and you really got to work your stuff out. Otherwise, you get mired and like, hey, you're playing the bass note. No, I'm playing my part.
Exactly.
It's not the bass part. It's just my part, you know. So you got to figure out where your part is and where you're, you know, where you want to put your frequency.
Yeah, and that's what I love about you, Edwin. I mean, it's bass players, we don't get to meet that often because we're always on other gigs, right? Except for your situation, there's not usually two bass players on a gig.
Very rarely, yeah.
So when I've met you and seen you and heard you play is actually with John Clayton Bass Monsters with a bunch of bass players. And I've seen you, of course, other times. But what I love about you, and I can tell from your playing and your composition, is like you're just a fearless person. And I think that comes from your... I mean, this is just me being outside, but you just seem so confident and fearless. And that's what I love about you. It's just kind of, or like you're just willing to try anything at any moment.
It doesn't hurt to keep your options open. You know, there's no reason, you know, that's a good example, because John Clayton had this idea of having, hey, let's get a bunch. I mean, it's not necessarily his, it's not a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
John said, hey, let's put this thing together. And there again, John being the monster that he is, I was like, yes, please. I'd like to do that. And it's a challenge to have two bass players play together, let mm-hmm. alone six or eight at the same time. And it's the same thing. You have to figure out where you want to put your part. And it's funny with the cats who know, like yourself and everyone else, I mean, you know where the frequencies lay, mm-hmm. you know, and you know where to put your part. Figure, okay, if he's doing that, I could play this here or in this register. Or if you do it in the same register, how to make it work.
Yeah, with different timbres and everything.
Totally.
Yeah,
totally.
I love it because you brought in a chart. I think it was altogether, last time we did it, maybe 9 bass players, including John Clayton. It was either 8 or 9.
Yeah, in the first one that we did, I had a piece that I wrote several years before for a bass, I think for a bass, a sextet. Mm-hmm. And then this most recent one, fall of 2019.
Yeah.
I wrote one just before that. I wrote a new piece for that one. And that was, I think, for bass, also bass sextet or quintet or something.
I
and
think
it was,
so.
Yeah, it was, and there again, it helps to have cats who kind of know what time it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, pros who can understand, okay, this is how we're going to do this. This is very, you know, it really helped. It helps me and helps a person or a composer know who you're playing for and who you're writing for. And who's going to perform your piece? Because I knew that you cats could all play and read.
Mm-hmm.
So I had nothing but confidence in the fact that this is going to be killing. Because everyone was confident in what they had to do. There's no like, yeah, well, you have a B, but like, no, it's a B. Just
yeah,
play it.
Exactly. It was awesome because I can't remember if it was this last one or the one before, but it was like in 7/8 and then 4/4, and it was so minimal the way you stacked everything, and it was just like you were so confident and just like, yep, that's it, this is what we're doing, and I loved it, and it sounded great, and it's had such a great effect.
I agree. I was very happy how it sounded also, and there again, everyone played well. I mean, mm-hmm. I was like, wow, so this is what it sounds like when you have cats playing your music properly.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. It was great for me. Yeah,
that was awesome. Okay, I gotta stay on trend here.
Okay.
On track here. Actually, I don't. No one's telling me what to do, Edwin. I'm the boss of me.
Hey, do what you want to do.
Exactly.
Damn it. I don't care what they say.
So I'm curious, how long did you spend in Austin? Because it still is like known as this crazy eclectic scene for everything. Art, music, food.
Yeah. It's funny. I wasn't there. I guess it seemed like a long time back in the day. But in the scheme of things now, I was there for only 5 years. But it was good for me. I met a lot of monster players who, of course, people I still know today. And some of those players have played with, you know, monsters. I mean, mm-hmm. cats who are living there, who still live there, played with Janet Jackson, Liz Wright, Angelique, Kijo, John Mayer. And these are all cats that I still know today. And those guys really helped my playing.
Mm-hmm.
By playing with them and seeing how they approach music and how they, you know, navigate songs and pieces and environments, like how to treat each other on gig or how to meet people. It was very helpful for me to see that.
Yeah. And when did you start touring? Because I mean, we haven't even got into that, like the amount of people you've played with.
I was doing some minimal touring out of Austin, which was cool because that was one of my first times of ever going on the road, quote unquote. And that means a lot. That could be anything, like getting in a van and driving to a gig.
Yeah.
That's going on the road. This mm-hmm. is a gig. Hey, it doesn't pay much, but it's a gig that they're going to pay you for. They're going to pay you to hear you play.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say then that was in Austin. So,
mm-hmm.
And I was there for 5 years. And then I moved to New Orleans. And that was also, and that was when I started the heavy touring. Because I started with a band called Los Hombres Calientes.
Yeah.
Which is the Hot Men. That's not my name. That's the name of the band.
You're excluded from that title.
Yeah. Yes. Cause I was not one of the leaders. I was the bass player. So
you were a hot bass player in the background.
I knew what my role was.
Yeah.
Some people, I was hot physically. Yes. Hot on stage for sure. But, that was cool because one of the leaders was a guy named Bill Summers, and Bill Summers was a percussionist with Herbie Hancock's Headhunters.
Mm.
And Bill has a vast knowledge of the Afro-Cuban music and of the diaspora.
Wow.
And he was playing like monster congas, bata drums, and giving us all Afro information and tons of stories from Herbie from the 70s, because Bill's on the very first record. He's on the Headhunters record. That's him playing on a Watermelon Man, the and that's Bill. It's called a Windy Woo whistle, and it's a bottle that's half filled with water. You can make the noises with it, and that's from like an aboriginal, and that is from a pygmy tribe in Africa who does that. Bill heard that, and then Bill, of course, not just him, but Bill put that on Herbie's record,
mm-hmm.
and then I learned all that from playing with him, and then via Bill, I met Paul Jackson, the bass player
mm-hmm.
from the Headhunters, and Mike Clark from the Headhunters, and they're two monsters, legends, sweetest cats ever.
Oh, that's so great when that happens.
Paul Jackson is like a big dude. His electric, he plays both basses, but I guess mainly electric nowadays. But and it's funny because Paul Jackson and Mike Clark grew up together in the Bay Area. Hmm. And they were like freaking brothers. And that's why when you hear Paul Jackson and Mike Clark play together on those records, it's, man, it is no joke.
Yeah.
Cats have a thing, and it's tangible.
It's not Pro Tools.
No, that is way pre, that's an analog. Mm-hmm. It's called the hookup.
Yeah.
If you hear that, man, you're good to go. Mm-hmm. And there can be a Bill Summers in this band. I met them. So it was always, and Bill was only one of three leaders in the band at the time. It was Bill Summers, Jason Marsalis was the leader. He was a drummer. Oh, they're from the Marsalis family.
Yeah.
The youngest brother. And then a guy named Irvin Mayfield on trumpet. Mm. So there were three leaders in the band. And that was what I was doing a lot of touring with there out of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And playing with Bill Summers, it must have been great to learn all those different rhythms too. Because as a bass player, it's kind of like,
it's the same thing.
You can step on somebody's toes so quickly.
Yeah. It's funny, after checking that stuff out and then doing a little my own research, I realized that the bass is very similar to the conga, the patterns and the timbre. Because mm-hmm. There again, I'm not a percussion expert. I'm not an expert in the Yoruba people or the music of Cuba via Africa, via Nigeria. But it seems like that there's a big reference or there's a similarity in between the bass lines and the conga pattern. If you're going boom, ping, boom, 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 ping, boom, that's what the bass does. But that's what the conga pattern does. Mm-hmm. You know, and once I realized that, that totally helped me lock in more with Bill and helped me really understand my role playing that music, you know.
It's interesting depending on like who you're like which percussionist or which drummer you're playing with, because sometimes I feel like if I'm playing with a Brazilian cat, I'm like, okay, let me lock in with their bass drum, but they're improvising all the time, and so it's you really have to listen.
Yeah, you got to have your ears and eyes, you know. I mean, because I was doing a tour back in mid 2000s in Spain. It was cool because I was in Spain for like almost a month, and that was cool in itself because I've never really been to Spain before, so that was amazing. And I was playing with a percussionist over there, and it's funny, this cat, you know, he'd count the tune off, and then he would immediately start to improvise. So it's like, I mean, I couldn't rely on him for the rhythm and the time.
Yeah.
So it was like, at first couple times, like, wow, this cat is just doing this thing. But that's how it was.
Yeah.
So that means I had to make sure that my stuff was correct.
Exactly.
He's straight.
Yeah.
So I got to make sure that, you know, my part was, hey, look, if he's going to do that, I need to make sure that I'm, you know, really playing a foundational role and make sure that my, whatever music rhythms and patterns are very solid, you know? So it was, that was also a good experience. Cause some cats, they won't give it to you.
No, they will not.
Say, hey, look, where's the time? Hey, man, you know, I've got my time. Where's your time?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's like you got to know where your own stuff is. You got to know where your own time is and your own feel to make sure that you can play well with others.
Exactly. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you're one of the hot men in the background touring in from New Orleans. And how'd you make your way to LA eventually?
Funny you should ask that question.
Oh, okay.
No, not really. But I got here somehow.
Yeah.
They were shooting the film called Ray. You know, Ray with Jamie Foxx. And they shoot a lot of films in New Orleans because it's a right-to-work state, mm-hmm. which means it's a non-union state. So it's good and bad. It's that's a whole other conversation. But
yeah,
bad thing is you don't get any residuals or any extra money. You get paid once, that's it. So that's a kind of a drag. But anyway, I was in the film Ray, I was hanging out with one of the people, I'm not gonna name names, but a person in the costume department. We became friends, and she said, "Hey, you should move to LA." And I was like, Well, I was going to go to New York, you know, because at that point I was, the gigs were kind of waning for me. Mm-hmm. So I was getting antsy and I wanted to move.
Yeah.
And she goes, you come out to L.A. I was like, well, I think about New York. She's like, well, you can live with me if you come to L.A.
Okay.
I was like, well, you know what? L.A. doesn't sound too bad.
Yeah.
So I moved to L.A. And I've been here since that time. But yeah, I came because of a woman. Yeah. I'll leave nameless, but it was you know, it was cool.
I think that's how a lot of people end up here.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of people always end up someplace either out of, hey, you're there, I'll go there too, or, you know, it's rarely because I just gotta go.
Yeah.
To, you know, whomever, wherever, but. Yeah.
Did you know anybody in LA when you got here?
No. See, that was part of the, it was funny because I flew out a couple times to make the hang. Mm-hmm. So at that point I was flying out maybe 3-4 times a year, kind of, you know, Southwest, cheap flights, just yeah. Come out real quick.
Little quick plug for Southwest.
Oh yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I love Southwest.
Okay. Well, good. Okay, cool.
It's $75 to take your base on.
Well, yeah. Not anymore, because there's no more flights.
No, not anymore. So,
I mean, yes. Anyway, wrong conversation. My bad. But yeah, I was coming out and I was hanging. You know, I was trying to make the hang, and I found a place called Charlie O's mm-hmm. that was still open back then. And I met, you know, I was hanging out with cats, and I met a cat named John Hurd, famous mm-hmm. bassist, played with a pile of people, Oscar Peterson to Joe Henderson to. A plethora of cats hanging out at I mean, he was like the bass player at Charlie O's,
yeah,
back
like every night. Yeah,
he was there, like that was like his house. And then I met a drummer named Lorca Hart mm-hmm. who was playing there a lot at the time. So I was starting to meet like a few cats on occasion to say, hey man, I'm coming out, I'm moving out here. And they're like, great man, let us know when you get here.
Yeah,
which that's cool. But as you know, and your readers, listeners will know, or whatever, it's like, I mean, that doesn't mean necessarily, that doesn't always mean that them saying, hey man, come on out,
yeah,
doesn't translate into gigs.
Yeah, it doesn't mean I have a gig for you.
Yes, it means, yeah. Hey, cool, join the other 150,000 bass players out here. Yeah,
yeah,
come on out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So I did that, but yeah, I soon realized, because this is, you know, a very large city that, I mean, there's tons of cats here. Mm-hmm. Same as in New York, but, you know, still, you know, yeah, just tons of cats. And you have to go through the process of being vetted by musicians and bands and people. So it's I had to start that process in every city that I've lived in. That's just what I've come up, I've grown accustomed to.
Yeah.
You know, you just, that's how it is. You got to prove yourself everywhere you go. And that's how it is on most gigs every night.
Yep. Yes, exactly. Even if you've been on the gig.
Oh, yeah. If you have a bad night, man, you're thinking, oh, good Lord, how many people heard that?
Yeah.
And tomorrow night cannot be as bad as last night. Yeah. You know, I've got to keep my level up and my...
your level, you know, of badness up, your badassness. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you got to keep it up because every night is different. And it's true when they say, you don't know who's listening.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
You don't know who's out there in the dark, in the back, by the bar, hanging out. I mean, there's cats everywhere, and they're checking you out.
Have you ever had one of those moments where you're just playing, and you don't know, you know, someone's there, and they come up to you afterwards, and it's, you know, anybody?
I've had that a couple times. It's not always, it's funny, because it's not always who you think it is, but it's always somebody, or maybe sometimes when I meet someone later in the future and say, oh yeah, man, I heard you play, man, like a year ago at so-and-so. I'm like, good Lord, you did? You were there for that, you know? Yeah. And they say, yeah, it was killing. You're like, okay, great. I'm glad you dug it.
Yeah.
But you never know. I mean, there is always, I mean, it could be the diviest bar, mm-hmm. two people out there, no money, and someone's going to be there.
And that's why you have to play your ass off no matter what, in no matter what situation.
Yeah, yeah, and it's pretty interesting because every situation is different. Because if you're on the road, you may be having this, may have what we call a base du jour.
Yes,
that means if you don't have your own base, you are lucky enough to get a horrible instrument.
Something with four strings.
Yeah, something that's supposed to be a bass, but it's not a bass, and you're forced to play it, and you're still forced to sound like you're the cat,
you know,
on this random instrument, and it's very difficult to do, you know, and you got to be able to bring it. You have to be able to bring that kind of intensity on any instrument at any time, and it can be very difficult at times. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't travel with my bass at all anymore, just because it's just too much, you know, to do that all.
Yep.
And I've actually grown to really like, you know, getting whatever bass I get to try and find. Yeah, it kind of inspires you to do something different. Depending on, I remember I got a bass in Serbia that was like a piece of a cello, a piece of a boat, you know, a piece of an audience seat, and I was like, wow, this is really cool. So it almost was like a like inspired me to play like some more Mingus type stuff, because it was just like getting out some raw energy, and I've grown to like it, where at first I was just like, oh my gosh, like this doesn't sound like me. But like I've learned from John Clayton and from Ray Brown, it's like the sound is, you know, in your fingers and,
totally.
And you know what you hear.
Totally, that's true. I agree with that. That's very true. And it's funny because I bought a David Gage trunk back in the day. That took me forever to pay off, because I bought it for a gig, and they said, well, you got to have your own bass. I'm like, and it was one of those things where you just, you know, you had to do it. So I just did it, blah, blah, blah. I did it. And I have this trunk now, and I have used my own bass on the road in at least 5 years. And I have this trunk that I am not going to use, I don't think, ever again, because like you, I have no desire to drag that or ship that to the airport and expect someone to pay for that.
Yeah.
And I'm not, no.
And then most likely it's you or me carrying it around everywhere.
Yeah, I'm not, yeah.
Mine's in my kitchen right now.
I'm not surprised.
I'm thinking about installing it into my yard as a pond, you know, digging it in and, you know, putting some koi fish in there.
Yeah, koi. Koi love the bass.
They love that vibration.
That's right.
So how did you get to, I mean, I feel by looking at your credentials that you're in a recording studio or on a set every day. Like, I mean, I see you've been recorded with Mary J. Blige, like you've played with Seal, Melody Gardot, like on the road with her. And then I went to go see the Star Wars Episode 9 premiere, and I'm looking at this was in December. I'm looking at the commercial, and then there's Edwin Livingston in a Cadillac commercial, and I'm like, how do you do all this stuff? So how did you get into that scene of recording, not just recording, but also on screen?
I think that all stems from the, hold on, let me get this stuff right. Strangeness, sorry, pop-ups. That all stems from the Ray movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the first time I'd ever been on a movie set. You know, and I was really unaware of what all it took to make a film,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I didn't know that like five or 10 minute scene can take a full day, 12 hours or more to shoot this one scene. And I was like, this is amazing. And so I'm thinking about all these crazy movies I've seen in the past, and it took, you know, must have taken them forever to shoot all those scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a fascinating process, and I was really very taken with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came to LA, I was down to do more. So, you know, I was, if someone approached me, I totally told them, yeah, I'll do it. I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And also I had to audition for the Cadillac one. So that was an actual, you know, and the byline was called, we had to be, because it's like a band, you know, that's what we're walking down the red carpet, and that was called Rocker Dads. So
okay,
so for some reason y'all had to look a little older, so I didn't shave. I kept a little gray there and a little gray in places and all that. And it was, you know, some of these are based on auditions. And I just chose to do that because I think it's fun to do. I mean, and also if I can get paid for it, I'm not going to turn down a gig. I mean, it's a gig, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I thought it was so cool because they could have picked, I don't know if all the actors were musicians, but I was like, it was just cool for me in the audience to be like, wow, these, at least I know for sure you, I was like, wow, that's an actual musician playing a musician's role. I thought that was so cool.
Yeah, I agree. Because we've all seen movies and things and films and TV shows and commercials of people playing instruments and they're not musicians.
No.
So you can tell, like, he holds a saxophone with his right hand. Wow. Yeah, he's not a saxophone. Yeah. There's no reed on the mouthpiece or, you know, it's like, come on, man. You know, it's just, well, there's, I recall seeing a Star Trek episode back in the day, and there's a guy playing bass in one of their holodeck scenes. And the guy is a tall guy, but the bass is all the way down on the ground, you know, with no input.
Yeah.
And he's playing it like this. It's just hands are just doing this the whole, it's like,
oh, come on, Star Trek.
They could find a bass player?
Yeah.
Come
exactly.
On, man. I mean, so, you know, I know what you mean. I think most of the guys on that commercial were musicians of some sort. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how long did it take you to get acclimated on the scene? I mean, and you've been, I mean, also like you played with Natalie Cole. And like I said, you were touring with Melody Gardot for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, that all happened from moving to LA.
Yeah, totally. I mean, some of those things could not have happened had I stayed where I was, I think. Because mm-hmm. Most of those, I mean, you know, the gigs you mentioned, I got all those gigs by living here in LA, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was, and there again, those were all based on auditions, so to speak. I mean, because most of those, it's always word of mouth for a lot of gigs nowadays. And the funny thing is, I've got most of my really good gigs from drummers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good to keep that relationship going.
Yeah, and I've always loved the drums. I've always been a big fan of drummers in general. I love drummers. And so when I play with the drummer, that's my first thing to do is hook up with the drummer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially if the drummer, well, it doesn't matter, but if the drummer is an actual, like, cat and known to be, you know, solid,
mm-hmm.
cool. And it's my job to make sure that from the get-go, we are straight.
Yeah.
Bass and drums are like this the whole time, you know, and also not being a jerk. You know, you can't do a job and expect to work, you know.
Yeah, that goes so far. I mean, that can hurt you so fast.
Totally, totally. I agree.
And you're also, you're still teaching at USC as well?
Yep, I'm teaching currently at USC via Zoom.
Okay.
And also at LOXA, the High School for the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen you over there before. You've played
That's right, yeah.
A couple times.
What do you...
I remember that.
Yeah, exactly.
And I teach there, but it's also there again via Zoom.
Yeah.
And both of these are part-time gigs, so mm-hmm. they're not...
So you're still available, is what you're saying.
Completely.
Yes. What do you like about teaching? I mean, not via Zoom, but just in general.
Yeah, because Zoom is, that's a whole other conversation about that. But in general, I think it's good to instill in, like, if these are younger people, it's a good to instill in them the how much fun it is to do what you want to do musically, but still to really have a sense of pride in it and to take it seriously
mm-hmm.
and to really try to excel. Because we all know that they say music is not a competition. This is not a competition, blah, blah, blah. And it's not, but it is.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to get to a certain level of playing to get to a certain point.
Yeah.
I mean, if you never excel as a bassist or as a musician, then rest assured you will not be playing with certain people. You know, that's just a fact, you know. And that goes for anything. That could be for sports or math or science. If you excel at what you do, then you're going to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the main thing is trying to instill in these kids, the younger ones that I'm talking about, you know, I guess high school and college, I guess, is trying to get them to understand that, I mean, it's still fun to play with your friends and to write music, play all kinds of stuff. But to, you know, it's also fun to take it seriously and really try to, you know, further your education and your knowledge.
Yeah.
Either via the music or via the instrument. You know, I think it's good to know.
Do you think like anything, I mean, since you've been teaching for a long time, any differences from when you were growing up to students today that could be good or bad or just different?
Well, it's, I mean, in lieu of sounding like some old cat, it's like back in my day, we didn't have YouTube.
No.
We didn't have access to this, all this information. I mean, mm-hmm. Now you go to YouTube and you can pull up a video of almost anyone playing live.
Mm-hmm.
From Bird to Train to anything, any classical thing almost. I mean, at least the pieces being played, at least. I mean, current cats, live gigs anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a tremendous tool to have, but you can't rely solely on that. You got to use your ears and really, you know, transcribe things, check things out. Because that's, I think the main thing is that sometimes I feel that the kids nowadays or cats nowadays don't always utilize their tools to their full potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe just like checking out one track from a record and maybe just the solo from the record as opposed to everything.
Yeah, I mean, because it's like I was talking about this 2 days ago. Like, I think either My Funny Valentine or Four More, or maybe this, it was the Miles Davis version of Daryl Stockholm,
mm-hmm.
but it's the sextet version with J.J. Johnson and Jackie McLean,
mm-hmm.
and not the one with Train and Cannonball. I had to represent, I said, look, this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
This is with Oscar Pettiford on bass, not the one with PC on bass.
Mm-hmm.
Different versions, you know, and I said, you guys got to know who was playing on this record because it means something.
Yeah.
I mean, because a Cannonball is not the same cat as Jackie McLean.
Exactly.
You have to know the difference. Like, yeah. These are two cats who are living at the same time and playing a pile of horn, but very differently.
Mm-hmm.
You got to know the difference of what's going on around you. So you really, behooves you to really get into these songs and figure out who's on it, who wrote it, are there lyrics to it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it, and then, and not just that, but okay, that's one version. The other version that I'm talking about is a live version with Train. I think Train, PC, and it has all those kicks on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to know exactly what you're doing. And, you know, it's being more knowledgeable, I think, in general.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find yourself like doing this, pointing your finger at kids a lot, or shaking your head?
I'm always saying, "Get off my lawn."
Oh yeah.
No, I'm not saying. I don't have a lawn. But I mean, you know, on occasion, it does seem like that's kind of the vibe.
Yeah.
But I think that's just how it is. I mean, as we get older and more mature. Musicians, all these cats start coming up out of the woodworks, and you realize, like, yeah, well, you know, you kids may want to check this out too.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, that sounds good, but do you know what song that came from?
Mm-hmm.
That's not an original song. That's called whatever, bebop or counterfact.
Yeah.
These are changes we've written here before, you know, the song that you're playing. So it's, you know, on occasion, yeah, I do find myself shaking my finger at some kids on my lawn, yes.
Yeah. Well, what are you working on these days musically?
Well, funny you mentioned that. I've been working on a few pieces of compositions that I've started this past summer, like a few months ago. There again, that may relate to the current events of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I'm in my second year of a performer composer degree at CalArts. So I'm doing a lot more writing now.
Oh, wow. That's now amazing.
That I'm going to CalArts getting my, I'm an MFA.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I figured I'd always wanted to go back.
Yeah.
You know, and I figured, yeah.
Just go for it. Now's the time.
I'm not going to get any younger, so I better do it now.
Yeah. I think I've almost covered everything about how you're the silent badass. I mean, do you have any like parting words of wisdom for people? Cause I mean, I have the feeling that you didn't picture like you didn't picture yourself here like today. Like, I feel like you didn't plan like to play with Natalie Cole or Frankie Valli and all these people. It just kind of happened because you were prepared and at the right place at the right time.
Well, it's funny. It's those two gigs, Frankie Valli and Natalie Cole, I got both of those gigs from drummers. I mean, it's literally every gig with the Serious Cat that I've gotten a call for or been recommended for has come from a drummer. Peter Erskine, same thing. It's like, and I would say really, first of all, really know your instrument and know your music. Don't be afraid to play something that's different or unusual or hard, because that's going to happen anyway. You should be prepared to play almost anything. If it's a 7 sharps, man, you just got to get those glasses on.
Yeah.
Sure, you get those B sharps and all the A sharps, but that's just the vibe. That's just how it is, you know. And I'll say you really try to be prepared, so when you do get the call, you're more likely to get the call back, you know, as opposed to folding. You know, just being more prepared and also staying cool. You know, it really doesn't pay to be the cat that people don't like. You know, it doesn't.
That hasn't paid off. No,
it literally does not pay. It literally does not pay to be the cat that
no one calls, no one pays.
Yeah, just be on your instrument, know your bass, know your music, and be cool.
I like that. Know your bass, know your instrument, be cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Edwin. This was so great to catch up with you. Nice to talk to another bass player. And you're number one. You're episode number one. This is great.
This is one of hundreds.
Exactly. One of hundreds. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Well, awesome, Edwin. You stay safe. Continue to be safe.
Thank you. Likewise.
I'm sending you my best wishes, and thank you again. This was awesome.
Of course. So thank you very much for the invite, Katie.
I can't wait to hear your music, too.
Yeah. Same. Me, too. I want to hear it, too. It's not finished yet, so I'll let you know.
Okay. Well, awesome. Thanks so much, Edwin.
Thank you, Katie.
Bye.